Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. As always, it's great to have you here with us. And this is, I've got to tell you, this is one of the great thrills. As you guys know, I've been doing this show since 46, 47. After coming back from the war, we've had Bing Crosby on here. Of course, Crosby and David Bowie in the early 70s, one of my favorites. But this has got to be my favorite. John Heilman of Circus fame, of Recount fame, of Joy.
Morning Joe
fame. Of Morning Joe fame. Thank you. Thank you for being here, John Heilman.
Well, listen, here's the thing. You're going to let me tell this story, right? Because I've been on this podcast before, but apparently, like, when we recorded, it was like in the pilot phase of the podcast, which was
in the pilot
in the deep, deep winter, in the deep, dark winter of 2021.
Yep.
And I have no idea what we talked about, but it was a great conversation. And I kept thinking, when's that podcast going to come out? And and now I think it's going to be part of like some DVD retrospective. When
I think so. I mean, some of this stuff, you know, is not as timely. They're the basement tapes. We talked about Bill Cosby. Yeah. He was still in jail at the time. Yeah. He's now, of course, out of jail. Yeah. We talked about a lot of different things. So this it seemed like, you know, we need to freshen this up. But yeah, those are going to be the basement tapes.
The basement tapes, you know, those are the kind of things that the collectors love down the line when they're like, oh my God, the basement.
Oh, of course.
Unreleased tracks, unreleased podcast episodes from the Scarborough Show. Man, we'll listen to those in the future.
Kids in the former Soviet Union are going to be passing around cassette tapes. Of the early outtakes of the Joe Scarborough podcast. Eight tracks. It's going to be great. They're going to be walking around boombox with the eight tracks. You know, so yeah, we did talk about, we also talked about the.
Let's not waste time on an old documentary.
Yeah, we won't we won't waste time on an old documentary. I want to talk about your shirt, Joy Division. Now, as you know, like I like bands that, you know, that your next door neighbor's sister have heard of. I don't go really deep in the weeds sometime, but Joey Scarborough said, hey, I know you've heard of Joy Division. I know you may have listened to them again, but he shoved the music in my face and said, you have got to listen to these guys because it was like they were shot out of a cannon from 1987 in Manchester, and they were doing shit way before anybody else was. And I listened. It is extraordinary stuff, even 40 years later.
There's a scene in one of the Trip movies of the guys driving through the English countryside, listening to this very, you know, that industrial Manchester sound that then, you know, became huge with, you know, Oasis and Happy Mondays and all these bands in the early 90s was kind of invented by those guys. And Ian Curtis, the lead singer, you know, famously killed himself and ended the band and by killing himself, brought that version of Joy Division to an end. And the song that most people know of Joy Division, that's the most famous and is a beautiful, beautiful song, is Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Oh,
and it's incredible. Deeply tragic song, and it kind of embodied a certain kind of attitude towards rock and towards industrial North England and romanticism and poetry. And then it came out after Curtis had killed himself. It became a huge hit. And that, just something about the romance and the tragedy of that story that's always appealed to me, and the fact that the band picked itself up after Ian Curtis had killed himself and made itself into a new band called New Order that continues to play till this day and kind of redefine modern dance music, British white dance music in the 90s. It's just, I find it really inspirational. And Bernard Sumner, who's the lead singer in that band, Ian Curtis was the band.
Right.
And there was no way Joy Division could exist without Ian Curtis. And then New Order became a vastly popular band over the course of the next 30 years. So I love that, the whole story. And I love both incarnations of the band. And they're some of my favorites.
It is incredible. And you listen to Love Will Tear Us Apart. It is. It's a deeply haunting song. And it's one of those songs, again, that was 10, 12, 15 years before its time. And as somebody who loves music just like you, you sit there and you wonder, all right, what made them think?
Yes, 100%.
Like that they were going to go into a studio and do something so radically different. There was something even more radical than what the Sex Pistols did. Now, listen, I'm one of these people. I'm going to ask you where you fall on. It's kind of like Love Actually. You either love Love Actually or you hate Love Actually. When it comes to the Sex Pistols, I know a lot of people thought that it was just a little too clever by half. I'm all in for the Sex Pistols.
My history
of rock and roll is Elvis in 55, the Beatles in 62, of course Hendrix and a lot of other people in the late 60s.
Yeah.
But man, the Sex Pistols 1976, like they were just an absolute thunderclap and against all of the gross excesses that were overtaking rock and roll?
The Sex Pistols were, Sex Pistols changed everything. And there's just not very many bands that changed everything that I don't love. So, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, if you read, as I, you're an Anglophile, so, you know, if you read, like, read John Savage's England's Dreaming, which is his kind of social history of Britain in the 70s, in that period, in the 70s and 80s, and when the Sex Pistols came along and the punk revolution happened, and what Britain was like in that, in that labor, that late labor, pre-Thatcher moment, and that punk came along and just, and was as much of a transformative influence on England and the world as the Beatles were in a different way. And I just, without the Sex Pistols, none of it really happens. And the Clash is a much better band. There's no doubt the Clash is a better band than the Sex Pistols.
Right.
But without the Sex Pistols, there is no Clash. I don't think Joe Strummer would even, fought with you about that. So it's like, I don't know. I mean, are there ridiculous things about the Sex Pistols? For sure. You know, or Sid and Nancy are kind of easily, both tragic and easy to parody. Was Malcolm McLaren a complete huckster? He was also a total genius. There's a lot of things you can say about them, but I mean, to not like them would be to clearly reject the spirit of rock and roll. And I'm not.
Well, and that's the thing about them, the spirit of rock and roll. And yes, there was tragedy around it.
Yeah.
But there was something that was just the essence, the stripped down essence of not only rock and roll, but the rock and roll story. I know both of us, we absolutely love the story of McCartney saying the hell with it. I'm leaving my posh surroundings in London, and we are going to be a band on the run. I'm going to Lagos, Nigeria, just out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But here with the Sex Pistols, you had a bassist that didn't know how to play bass.
Right.
That they brought into the band. He'd been playing bass for like 6 months. They blew up. It was massive. They changed the way London looked. They changed the way the world looked. They changed music. People like Elvis Costello and The Clash were listening. They changed the course of rock and roll. And then, like any great rock and roll story, boom, like that, it's over.
But here's the thing about this, Joe, that her also say this about the Sex Pistols, which is, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I just watched this documentary called The Promise about the making of Darkness on the Edge of Town, which is a doc that's about, Springsteen has just gotten famous with Born to Run.
Right.
And he's sort of deciding over the course of 3 years what he's going to be for the rest of his career. And he makes all these choices. It's amazing how different Darkness is from Born to Run, just as like his conception of himself and what he's putting forward to the world.
Yeah.
And I there's this thing that happens with I was talking about this with a good friend of mine who's a rock writer the other day about how you think about Springsteen as an example, Dylan's an example. If you go back and listen to Another Side of Bob Dylan, there's this moment where Dylan redefines himself. The next album is the first Electric record. And it's like these moments for people who are huge rock talents and musical geniuses who make a decision at some point that changes them into pop stars. And those are, I think, some of the most interesting people in music, right? Are people who are legitimate musical geniuses and also vastly popular and vastly transformational in some way. The Sex Pistols are a different category of thing, which is like they burst fully formed from the very beginning.
Right.
And that's like Joy Division's like that too. From the very beginning, they were pop stars. They were punk rock. It's like the hardest contradiction to get your head around. The Sex Pistols were like, we are everything that's anti-pop as you currently conceive it, but we want to change the world. And we want to be seen in a certain way and embody a certain image and have a certain identity that's going to be transformative. And your question goes back to Ian Curtis. Like, it's not just where did he hear that sound in his head that no one had ever made before, but where did he have this idea of himself that was completely new?
Exactly.
And that's the truth of the Sex Pistols too. It's like, we're, you know, Malcolm McLaren, Johnny Lydon, like, you know, how did they think that shit up? Not just what they sounded like, but what they look like and their attitude and the whole presentation was so novel from day one. That just blows my mind.
Well, and what blows my mind is, again, when somebody's sitting down in 1976 and saying, I'm going to write a song called Bodies, and it's going to be about abortion, which I'm going to paint in the most graphic manner possible. Not politically correct at all. Certainly not the safe thing to do. But then The Bridge. My God, I remember the first time listening to The Bridge. We can't, I'm just not going to repeat it. You can't repeat it here, but it is the rawest, most guttural, not only Bridge, but part of rock and roll, I think, up to that time, that anybody had ever recorded. And again, it's just like, I wonder, with Ian Curtis. What was he thinking when he went to the studio? Yeah. What were they thinking when they wrote Bodies? When somebody said, hey, yeah, this would be a wonderful bridge, right? Or, you know, same thing with David Byrne.
Yeah.
The first time that guy walked on stage, there was just something different about him, just like Hendrix, almost otherworldly. And for those of us who love music, who especially love rock and roll, it is. It's just like a gift from God.
The ones who are the originals, just, you know, I don't know. It's ineffable. I think you can ponder it for a long time where they, I mean, I, you know, people write about these people and they try to piece together their influences. And they, you can, it's like, you know, with David Byrne and other people, you know, some of these people went to art school and had, were trained in theory and had thought a lot about, you know, in some cases with McLaren and people like that were, you know, were reading Dadaist literature and stuff and trying to think about like the high theory and the construct of what they were trying to do. It's not like they were primitives, right? Some of them were super thoughtful about what they were doing and others were more instinctive, but you can't really get to that, to the thing of like, how did they hear that sound in their head?
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing where you can trace the influences and the family trees and the etymologies, but in the end, there's this thing that's missing, which is what's the thing that made that sound start playing in their head? And you hear it, it's true with Springsteen, it's true with Dylan, it's true with Madonna for that matter, it's true with Taylor Swift. It's like, you know, Taylor Swift writing songs at 17 that you're like, how can you possibly?
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I was like at 17, Taylor Swift writing perfect Bruce Springsteen songs at 17, and you're like, how does she, where did that come from? And you can write 50,000 words about it. You'd never really understand how that young woman was able to write like these perfect songs at that age.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense. There's something that's about it that's beyond reason.
They're beyond reason, but I will say those people, you brought up Madonna, which I was of course too cool to like Madonna when Madonna was out. The thing I started really appreciating about Madonna, and okay, yeah, I loved Material Girl. I loved the video. I loved Crazy for You. But the thing I noticed about Madonna was, here's somebody didn't really have a great voice. Nobody would look at her and go, oh, she's going to be a star. There's some people you can look at and say they're going to be stars. Not Madonna. But what she taught me was about these huge pop stars, rock stars, sometimes it's just a sheer force of will.
Yeah.
Madonna was going to be a star. I heard a story about her going and like giving her tape to somebody, a record executive, I think, when they were in the hospital. Madonna didn't give a shit. She was going to go in the hospital. He could be in the hospital if he wanted to. She wanted to be a star. Now, I can't remember the exact background of that story.
Right.
But she just had that sheer will to succeed, which, of course, you know, whether it's Taylor Swift, whether it's Bruce Springsteen, whether it's Dylan, they had to be stars, and they did what it took to get there.
Yes, 100%. And also, you know, in her case, like a lot of these people, you know, she was, you know, a downtown club kid in New York in that period when David Byrne was playing at CBGB. It's like she's down, you know, where I live basically now, which is not anything like what it was in the late 1970s, mm-hmm. You know, and she's going to clubs, she's going to danceteria. She's kind of like, you watch the movie Desperately Seeking Susan,
yeah,
with her and Roseanne Arquette. Great movie. And you look at her style in that movie. It's 1982, I think it came out, 1982, 83. And you look at her and you're like, she's a club kid, you know,
yeah,
who's picking up all these influences that she's going to ultimately weave together into this fabric that would then become the dominant style of the 80s when she really broke in 84 at the VMAs. And it's like, man, like she spent 7 years, 6 years floating around watching shit in the kind of underground subcultures and was realizing this is the stuff that I can pull together that will break through and make me the biggest female pop star in the world at that point.
Right.
And again, as you say, not someone with a lot of enormous musical training, not someone with a classically great voice, but who just got, who absorbed all of these influences and then fashioned this thing that was perfect for the moment.
Right.
And again, that's another one of those ineffable things. Where the fuck does that come from?
Yeah.
Who has that? Who has that? I mean, where does that genetic code come from that you're able to splice stuff together like that? I don't know. I mean, I find it's to me the unending glory of paying attention to this stuff, because you sit there and go, you know, we can talk about it to death, but in the end, there's just this spark that some of these people have that, you know, is beyond, I say, beyond our understanding.
I want to get to politics and Bill Maher in a minute, but it's still, it's mind-blowing that Paul McCartney.
Oh, my God.
And John Lennon grew up within, what, a couple of miles of each other? They bumped into each other.
Craziest thing ever.
I guess at a wedding or something when McCartney was 14. Yeah. It's the craziest thing ever. But these are two guys that came together, Both of them knew they wanted to be stars. Both of them had lost their mom. Both of them had this hole in their heart that needed to be filled by something. And I guess both of them just had such a fierce competition that they just pushed each other to be the greatest songwriters in rock history. And yet, again, just two kids from Liverpool.
Right.
It reminds me of the Bible verse when somebody's talking about Jesus and somebody says, what good ever comes from Nazareth? You could ask that question in rock and roll about Liverpool. Two guys from Liverpool are going to literally change the world. It's crazy.
Crazy happenstance. And I don't mean to keep quoting the Springsteen thing, but there's a moment in the Springsteen documentary where he says something like, as he's thinking about Making Darkness after Born to Run, he says something like, you know, more than I wanted to be famous, more than I wanted to be rich, more than I wanted to be something. And he said, I wanted to be great. That's what I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's something about, you read that David Remnick piece in The New Yorker, which I heard you talk about here the other day.
Oh, my God. It's
about
so
McCartney.
Great.
It comes through in all of the things, you know, the McCartney, Rick Rubin special. Every time McCartney's out a lot, right? And one of the things about that story is that McCartney cares a lot about how people think about him and think about his career and think about the Beatles. And he wants people to, in his view, get the story right. And the one thing that comes through in the way he talks about it all, and even when he's trying to be like, Mr. Oh, I'm just Paul McCartney, I just wrote a few tunes, you know.
The thing
that screams through that Remnick profile and then the story that he tells of the Beatles coming together in that piece and in every story of the Beatles coming together, and you and I have read all the Beatles books over the course of our lives, is just that they wanted to be great.
Right.
And they had this conception of greatness and what greatness meant. Again, for which there was no model. There were some rock stars, you know, when they got started. There were some rock stars. There was Little Richard. There was Chuck Berry. There were people around, right? Bill Haley.
Yeah.
But there was nothing that approached the image of what greatness would be that they were aspiring to without really – I mean, they had no roadmap for what they were trying to do. But it's very clear that they were drawing a roadmap. They were not just stumbling along throughout this thing. And that animation, just the whole story of them going to Hamburg, you know – is all about this kind of honing the craft, catching the wave, trying to do something no one else had done before, and with the ultimate goal of not just making great music, but being great and being seen as being great and changing the world. It's just all it's very much in the front of their minds. You can see it in everything they're doing. I don't know. It's that combination of accident that you just described. If they hadn't met each other in that one little town, you know, where would we be?
Yeah.
We'd all be lost.
Yeah.
But it's also that combination of accident and aspiration and inspiration and ambition. You know, that's, I guess, how you get the Beatles. And I think,
it's ambition and it's drive. And you can see it in the Remnick article. You can see it in McCartney's interviews. Here's a guy who has no peers. He has no – ask any musician. You know, what's it like being with Paul McCartney, two peers? And, you know, Billy Joel said it in the Remnick article.
Yeah.
I'm not his peer. Yeah. Nobody's this guy's peer.
It's like, I play second fiddle to McCartney because I'm – even at his own show, he's like, I'm second fiddle.
Yeah. He stands alone. The only peer Paul McCartney has ever had was killed 41 years ago. And so – but the thing about Paul, and I see this as a positive – he still has that drive. At 79, he's still competitive.
Yeah.
He's still in his mind competing against the Stones. He's still in his mind, though he can't say it. He's still competing against John. And before people get really offended and go, oh, how that's horrible. No, that's how they became great. They pushed each other to be great. And even from the beyond, John is still pushing Paul. And you talk about Springsteen just saying, I wanted to be great. I'm writing a book on Lincoln right now because I thought Abraham Lincoln would be a great person to write a book about because nobody's done it before, right? You think 60?
The Lincoln literature is a little thin. It's a little thin on the ground. If you're thinking about, I want to learn about that guy, Abraham Lincoln, you go to the library, there's nothing there. I'm like, where's the, I need a, is there some kind of a monograph somewhere that I can read?
The guy saved the Union? Seriously, do I have to go to the microfiche to read anything about this guy? No, there's so much that's been written about Lincoln, and I didn't realize how much until I really started diving into the book and the research. But Abraham Lincoln, suicidal throughout a good part of his life, depressed throughout a good part of his life, and a friend of his... basically, you know, at one point took all the knives and all the pistols out of the house. And he told Lincoln, you know, you keep on like this. You're either going to have to get better or you're going to kill yourself.
Yeah.
And Lincoln said that he couldn't do that because he hadn't done anything worthy for people to remember him throughout history. Right. Even when he was young Lincoln, even when he was depressed, his friends, his law partner said he was the most mournful, depressed person they had ever met. Like Springsteen, he wanted to be great. Yeah. He had the drive to write his name in the history books, and it kept him alive to save the Union.
We have to call Dr. Freud about this, because, of course, the hilarious thing about that, the perplexing thing about that, is someone who thinks so little of themselves that they want to kill themselves, but also doesn't kill themselves because they recognize they have the seeds of greatness in them. It's kind of there's a conundrum. But I'll tell you that my favorite thing, to your point about competitiveness, in that McCartney piece by Remnick, the best thing in it, and it made me actually laugh out loud, and I will laugh out loud again when I read it, is when Remnick writes, McCartney waves away such high-flown talk, but he isn't above suggesting that the Beatles work from a broader range of musical languages than their peers, not least the Rolling Stones. Here's the part that makes me laugh. Quote, I'm not sure I should say it, but they're a blues cover band. That's sort of what the Stones are, McCartney told me. I think our net was cast a bit wider than theirs. I mean, I just think that that's such a fucking great thing to say. It's hilarious. And so it's hilarious. Just can't stop laughing. It's the most, that's a guy. That's a Boston Red Sox coach talking about the New York Yankees. He's like, you can't admit that Derek Jeter's great. It's like, they're just like a blues cover band, Joe.
You know, Mantle, he was pretty good. Hit from both sides of the plate. But, he hit better from one side of the plate than the other. So there was a weakness. But, there's that hyper-competitiveness there, again, that they pushed each other and made them greater. But as you and I have said, the Rolling Stones, forget about what they were doing in the 1960s, which was incredible. I think we have difference. I'm a huge Beggars and Exile fan. I think you're more of a Let It Bleed fan. But we can both agree that somehow this band from London created the quintessential New York album when they released Some Girls in 1978. You listen to Some Girls in 1978. That is no blues cover band.
Yeah, and I think that is no blues cover band, you and I both, we share our admiration for that record. There's not a weak cut on that record and some incredible things on it. And again, I will say that it goes to the one, you can never have a reasonable conversation, I think, with McCartney about this, but it is the case that you have to give the Stones, in addition to them not just being a blues cover band, and Jagger being one of the most, Keith and Mick, embody something about rock and roll the Beatles never had. They have the Beatles are a broader and a greater pop band, I would say, and a greater pop cultural phenomenon in the 20th century than any probably anything. But as a rock
and greatest songwriters by a country mile. Even know how far Gilbert and Sullivan. Maybe you go back to
for
them.
Sure.
People will be singing Yesterday
forever
on the cliffs of Scotland. 400 years from now.
You can't, there's nothing you can say there's no way you could give too much praise to them as songwriters. But as a rock and roll band, both the whole spectrum of what the Rolling Stones have done over the course of their long career, and longevity counts, right? I mean, these guys are still kind of kicking ass in 2021, and that's no diss to McCartney, but those guys have been making rock and roll, and Keith and Mick, I think, to go to our Sex Pistols conversation, are more of an embodiment of just genuine rock and roll spirit than the Beatles were, just because the Beatles had that broader aspiration. They wrote, Eleanor Rigby's not a rock song. Yesterday is not a rock song. Those are great songs, but they're not rock songs. And Keith and Mick are kind of, they may be the endless undying image of what rock and roll is and means to people in a lot of ways over the course of the whole life of the form. So, maybe a little bit more than just a blues cover band, I would say.
I think I've heard every interview that the Beatles ever gave. I just, so people can understand where this competitive edge comes from and why the world's greatest band, the world's greatest songwriters, McCartney and Lennon, why there still may even be an edge all these years later about the Stones. May have to do with the fact, I heard Lennon one time, and it must have been in 70, 71, he was particularly pissed off. And somebody talked about the Rolling Stones and what revolutionaries they were. And he was like, wait a second, hold on. And basically said, I am sick and fucking tired of everybody talking about what revolutionaries they were. We put out Sgt. Pepper And then what? 6 months later, they put out their little satanic thing that's a ripoff of Sgt. Pepper. We put out the White Album. 6 months later, they put out Beggar's Banquet with a white sleeve. We put out Let It Be. It basically says they've spent their entire time imitating us from 64 to 70. And they're the revolutionaries? No. We're the revolutionaries. They're ripping us off, which I do get the point.
Yeah.
And I do think I think there's a reason why Exile and Sticky Fingers took the Stones to a new level.
Yes. Because the Beatles had to be gone.
Finally.
The Beatles had to be gone.
The Beatles broke up. That long shadow was no longer cast over them. They weren't always measured as second best, even if rock critics were saying, hey, they're the cool ones. And so I think that's where that resentment was. So it's like, please, do not call them the revolutionaries. Yeah. We're the revolutionaries. And this is all encompassed in Stella McCartney's T-shirt, one of the great T-shirts of all time. Her father finally inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame when he should have been like second behind Elvis. Yeah. And she has a T-shirt that says, about fucking time.
Yeah. It's funny, though. I will say this. You know, John Lennon in the early 70s was kind of a dick. I mean, it was like he was in that dick mode. Like, if you read I love John Lennon, but if you read even the McCartney piece again, you're reminded of how bitter and caustic he was about everybody. I mean, I get all the reasons why with the Rolling Stones. There's good reasons. John was a really smart guy. He could come up with good reasons for anything. But you get the sense that in that 70, 71 period, you know, the things he said about McCartney were vicious. The things he said about Harrison songs were vicious. The things he says about – basically, he's shit-talking everybody in that period.
Yeah, and everybody.
And it produces some – I mean, the first couple Lennon solo albums are genius. But he's a bitter, nasty kind of little. All of John's like most acidic qualities are brought to the fore.
Yeah, but even that ended up frustrating him because you know he'd come straight at McCartney with "How do you sleep?"
Yes,
and it was so bitter and straightforward. McCartney would sit back, and as John would say, he'd sit there with his bland face and speak in bland platitudes, and then he'd stab me in the back with too many people.
Yeah.
You know, but McCartney answers back to "How do you sleep?" a couple of years later, Band on the Run with "Let Me Roll It."
Yeah,
and that little primal scream at the end where he's mocking Lennon,
but
sounds just like Lennon. It's really brilliant. But you are right about Lennon. I won't mention their names, but I've talked to a couple of music legends and asked them, "Hey, you knew the Beatles? What are they?" And everybody says the same, Paul. Just a decent, wonderful guy. He's so kind. He's on another level, but he'll sit and talk to you. And they're like, "What was John like?" And it's, you know, he had an edge to him. It was very caustic, you know. There was in 74, I think, his lost weekend. There was a quote from one of the fans when he acted particularly bad in L.A. with Harry Nilsson on his lost weekend. And one of his fans said, you know, it's kind of heartbreaking when you find out that your hero is an asshole. So John had his tough times, but it was wonderful to see the last 5 years him go home, raise his son. And tragically, of course, it ended when he was on a high note.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the saddest thing about Lennon, of course, is that you sense that, you know, if you get to Double Fantasy, you know, the last record, it's like, I remember reading, you know, remember that there was that famous Rolling Stone cover with him and Yoko naked on the, like next to each other, not the two virgins naked full frontal, but the two of them, you know, kind of curled up with each other.
Right.
And when that came out, the whole story of that was, if I remember it right, was that Double Fantasy was like, all of the shit that Lennon went through psychologically and the therapy and all the various phases and all that 70s stuff that finally he had gotten to this place in 79 where he could make this record that was just joyful. I mean, Watching the Wheels is a beautiful, beautiful song, but it's reflective of a very different John Lennon than the one who talked to the press in 71, 72. And obviously it's miles away from the first Lennon solo album and all the kind of like deep inner torment. And really the great epic tragedy of Lennon is that he had finally reached this place where he was kind of at peace and in love and happy with himself and fulfilled and made that record as, you know, the best thing he'd made for years. And then, you know, he gets shot right at that moment when he's finally gotten to the place where he feels like he's at peace with himself. He's gunned down. And, I mean, we can talk about that all day.
You talk about Watching the Wilts, Beautiful Boy. There's so many songs on Double Fantasy that show that he had finally reached a place of peace. I will say, and then I promise we can get to politics for a second, but this always happens with us. You know, in one of his last interviews, I think it was a Playboy, Newsweek, was it Newsweek? He stiffed somebody during his comeback. So he had to sit down and do a long set of interviews. I don't think it was a Playboy interview. So I think that was in the early 70s. It may have been an interview with Newsweek. I'm not sure. But he went through a lot of the bitterness and the anger, and he explained it. And he had a better perspective on it. He was handling it better. He made a slight jab at George, and then he backed up and he apologized and said, you know, that his feelings had been hurt because George, in I Me Mine, a book that George did, he thanked, as John Lennon said, every two-bit saxophonist on planet Earth, but never thanked me for standing between him and Paul and making sure that he got his music out there. It was this extraordinary dynamic, but these people, there are only four people on the planet that understood each other. You know, they loved each other. They were brothers. They're still, Paul and Ringo still brothers. But yeah, very competitive. I'm sure it was, they grew up. What? Can you imagine being their age and growing up in the hot house that they had to grow up in? And could you imagine being McCartney and having to shake hands and be polite with people 55 years later? I don't know. Not to being polite to people, but you can't walk out. You can't go to a restaurant. You can't do anything without somebody going, can I get a picture? Can you show me? Hey, I don't want to bother you, but. And that's when they bother you for 5 hours.
He's without doubt the most recognized person in the world. And you know, he talks about it, you know, how he's, you know, even during COVID when he would have a mask on and sunglasses on and a baseball hat on.
Yeah.
They still would still come up and go, hey, Paul.
Bugging
it's like, they still know him. And I mean, he's incredibly gracious about the whole thing. But what a thing. And I actually just, you know, the last thing to say about this, the thing here that I'm always struck with as we talk about some of these acts and the Beatles most prominently, because the Beatles were the biggest, you know, this the biggest. At that moment, again, you could argue biggest pop cultural phenomenon of the 20th century. You could argue. I don't know. What's striking to me about it is that, you know, for a period of time when there was still a rock music industry to speak of, you know, with the whole, the record labels and the A&R people and the magazines and the MTV and all of that stuff, there was kind of a, could anybody be bigger than the Beatles, you know? Could you be bigger than the Beatles? Beatles are bigger than Jesus, said John, probably right, you know?
Right.
Could anybody be bigger than the Beatles? Or Springsteen, could he be bigger than the Beatles? And now the way that music is consumed and the way that the industry has been broken into a million little pieces, there's nothing like that anymore. You know, U2, you know, was like for a little while was the biggest band in the world. And that quality of, here's a band that everyone knows, love them or hate them, everyone knows. In the summer, you could walk down a street in New York City or Boston or LA or whatever, and you could hear that number one song playing out of everybody's car windows. And like that moment is now gone. It's irretrievably gone. There will never be anything like that again.
Yeah.
The way that music and culture works now is just so much more, is just entirely atomized and fractionalized. And so there will never be anybody. I mean, it's not because the Beatles are, it's not like that on the, it's, you can make this statement regardless of whether you are a Beatles lover or hater, the few of those who exist, there won't ever be in the world that we now live in, there never will be anything that big again. That's that all encompassing around the world where everybody knows who they are.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but it's a striking thing to me at least that you'll never, that we're kind of in that place. We're getting to that age, Joe, where stuff that we had at least some passing experience with, and for me, to some extent, it's like the magazine business is like that too. It's like, it's gone. It's just never will be back. And seeing these things pass away causes some reflection. Sometimes bittersweet, more bitter sometimes than sweet, but you notice that these large unifying things that dominated our early lives are not just out of fashion, but they're literally gone, and they won't come back.
Yeah. Well, you know, we used to rail against the gatekeepers, the people who decided who we listened to, the people who decided who we watched, the people who decided what we read, the news. What I found in my old age is gatekeepers, a very good thing, where you actually have people that make sure that the news you read, the TV that you watch, that there are at least a few gatekeepers to make sure that it's not just a free-for-all. It's not the Wild West like we see on Facebook. But let's bring it back to music. Do we think that Bruce Springsteen would have ever survived his first two or three albums and been developed and had all the money thrown at him that was thrown at him to get to Born to Run? Do we think Elton John would have been Elton John, that he would have gotten to Goodbye Yellow Brick Road in 73 if he had to struggle through, you know, basically what we see now from 69 to 70 to 71 to 72? It was, you know, 3-4 years before Elton John became Elton John. And that's where we're really missing the gatekeepers, the A&R people that are developing these stars and not only developing their image, but more importantly, making them, you know, great musicians, saying, no, that's not going to work. Why don't you do this? Why don't you, slide the bridge there? Why don't you change the words here? People go into the garage now and a lot of talented musicians, but we're not getting the same output that we've gotten over the past 30, 40 years.
Yeah, I'm of two minds about it. I mean, there's no question that the part of the description you're giving is right. I think that there's things about the democratization of culture that I think is great. There are a lot of people who complain not just about gatekeepers. People complain about the monoculture and how many of, when we talk about some of these groups that were so dominant and all the people we're talking about here, for instance, are white. And people kind of point out that, a lot of people who, a lot of these industries, and we've been kind of focused on rock and roll here, so it's a lot of people kind of point out the way in which it was hard for a lot of excluded groups to kind of break through. And so the notion that the industry structure changing could open doors to letting people find a way in that couldn't have found a way in if there were gatekeepers, I have sympathy for that. Yep. It's not like I have sympathy for that. And I think, what hasn't yet happened is a kind of really a robust economic structure that takes that democratizing impulse where it's like there's more doors to get in, but then allows the people who get in, who have talent, to get developed, and to go through the thing that every young artist needs to go through, which is, those years in Hamburg or those early Elton John albums or whatever, where it's like, how does a young inspired artist get in the door and then get the kind of support and economic, the ballast that allows them to keep working and not, have to give up on their art because they need to eat. How does that structure get built so that those young artists can develop into be great artists? The democratization has happened, but the economic underpinnings of it are still way underdeveloped. And so we'll see what happens. But
yeah,
I think even if it develops, what you're never going to have again, because the way that the media has been broken down, the way that subcultures have multiplied, the way that people now choose their own adventure in everything, whether it's not just, music, but it's television, it's film, it's anything that people consume. The book business has been affected. Everything that relates to content in any way, that's just never going to stitch itself up again so that, like, the audiences will be as big, big giants, best-selling books, great television shows, great sporting events even now just don't command the kind of they can't. It's just not possible. The math doesn't work. So you don't just see, you just don't see these giant audiences all kind of flocking to the same things. Everything's just too much out there. So everyone kind of goes their own way.
Yeah, it's hard to find a person who didn't hear about John Lennon's death watching Monday Night Football. I mean, it seems like everybody remembers listening to Howard Cosell break that terrible news because basically that's what everybody watched on Monday nights. We were all, about a global village.
Good example.
We had the global village. There are a couple examples in the media world where billionaires have come in, Bezos with the Washington Post, given them enough money to really expand their operations, and the Post is growing. Same thing with the Atlantic. Obviously, they have somebody that's really investing in them. That's making a big difference. I just haven't seen it. You're right. There's not an economic model yet in music. Let's talk about Bill Maher.
Yeah.
You and I were both talking about his slow moving coup that he's been talking about for some time. It really struck home with both of us. Talk about what you took away from it.
Well, I was struck by it. It obviously went viral when they put it out over the weekend last weekend, and people really paid attention to it. And I think there's the thesis of it, which is, I mean, stated not in with his, he doesn't state quite as clearly as I'm going to right now, but it's like, for number one, Donald Trump actually tried to stage a coup in 2020. We can't really argue about that anymore. It's not, people for a while debated, was that the right word? You know, did he really stage a coup? It was because people were focused too much on January 6th and the Capitol, right, which people were rightly focused on. But now we know what he was doing at the Justice Department. We now know about the Eastman memo, that there was a lawyer who was drafting a memo to try to convince Pence, to give Pence the legal, the ostensible bullshit, but the ostensible legal justification to overturn the Electoral College. There was methodical planning going on in agencies of government within the White House, not just like a riot on the at the Capitol. So there's no world where that's not what happened. And then the rest of the Mar monologue is basically about, we're watching this again, right? Which is where it's all in plain sight. If you think about the pieces of it, right? Trump is trying to purge the party of anybody who disagreed with him. There's a purge going on. If you disagree with Trump, if you're one of the 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach him, you're going to get a primary. You're all going to get a primary. And most of them are going to get Trump-endorsed primaries. Some of them, like Anthony Gonzalez in Ohio, have already dropped out because they realize that they can't fight the tide. You have to stand up and swear that the election was stolen in 2020, or else you're going to be read out of the party. So the cult of Trump has gotten stronger because of January 6th. Then you've got all these legal changes state by state that don't just suppress the vote, but engage in post-vote electoral subversion or allow that to happen. And then you've got the audits, which are all designed to basically kind of sow doubt in people's minds in all the battleground states about the legitimacy of the election. Trump is a clown and an idiot and had been totally incompetent in 2020. But what the Mar thing points out is that he's still, like all humans, a learning machine. It's like he's looking at this going, okay, we failed in 2020. What do I need to do to not fail in 2024? If I fall short in the vote, I want to be able to pull this coup off. And it's all right in front of our eyes. And we talk about it on television a fair amount, but in some ways, it's still an undercovered story. It's like, why was the Eastman memo not something that was like led the evening news for a week? I mean, the President of the United States had a lawyer in the White House, like drafting a legal rationale for the vice president to do something wildly unconstitutional and stay in office when he'd lost a legitimate election. It's just insane. And so you put all that together. I thought that it was great that Bill put it all together and laid it all out. Some of the stuff he did was speculative about what 2024 would look like was very speculative, but that's fine. The last thing I'll say is, someone who a staffer on the 1-6 commission said to me the other day that Trump won a huge victory with 1-6, even though he failed, and that he's got now 600 political prisoners, and that as we head to 2022, those Capitol rioters who are in jail will become a rallying cry for Trump and the Trump base. And this video we put out this week praising Ashley Babbitt, he's got 600 political prisoners, he's got a martyr. And that if you look around the country in pro-Trump districts, that the energy that's building around 1-6 being redefined as a glorious exercise in patriotism, not an act of insurrection, in the Trump side of the house is scary. And they're raising a ton of money off it. And there's a lot of people who are very fired up and people who are willing to commit violence as they did on 1-6. So that, I think, is like, this is the Michael Gerson column the other day.
Yeah.
The catastrophe's in the front room, man. The catastrophe's in the living room. The house is on fire. People need to pay attention.
And we have, again, we have two things happening at the same time. You have Trump supporters, an element of Trump supporters, becoming even more radicalized, becoming even more intense. Trump districts sending more extremists who aren't afraid to flirt with violence, promote violence, going to the United States Congress. And at the same time, you have former Republicans like myself, you have independents, you have other people who see this radicalism, who see this fascism, it's fascism, calls for fascism, and you're pushing more and more people from the suburbs of Atlanta, the suburbs around Phoenix, the suburbs around Philadelphia, pushing them further and further away from Donald Trump. I thought one of the most interesting, you can find all the negative polling that you want to find on Democrats and Joe Biden. And, I've been very critical of how the Democrats are just weak. Like, Republicans would not put up with this shit. I'll speak of myself as a former Republican. I wish I were running against people like this.
Yeah.
I would politically tear them to shreds. I would mock and ridicule them. Hell, imagine, I always said, imagine George W. Bush. George W. Bush, somebody that people said wasn't that smart, who deboned Ann Richards on a debate stage when he was Texas governor. It would take him less than 60 seconds to finish Donald Trump's career if he were debating him one-on-one in 2016. But I don't see a Democrat. I don't even see a Republican that has what it takes, that has the swagger to actually shut Donald Trump down, despite the fact that you do have a lot of people moving away from Trump. And the poll I was referencing before I got off on my George W. Bush tangent was they did focus groups with Trump supporters that voted for Biden in 20. And every one of those Trump supporters that voted for Biden in 20 were disappointed with Joe Biden. Highest grade Biden got out of the group was a C-. But then they asked the final question, the payoff question. Did you make a mistake? Do you wish you would have voted for Donald Trump? Every single one of them said, no, I'll never vote for Donald Trump again.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a lot of polling evidence. If you talk to people who are interested in the Republican Party and trying to reclaim it, to make it something like it was, again, what it was before Trump. You know, there's a lot of evidence if you look around at places like Georgia where lower-level Republican officials outperformed both Trump and Loeffler and Perdue, who were associated with Trump. And if you look at like Republican candidates that had nothing to do with the Trump national element, Republicans are doing fine. And you hear Republicans who point to those people and say, this is why Trump is, in fact, as much of the hold he has over the base of the party and over so much of the party is so bad for the party's ultimate growth. And look, if you want to be optimistic, if you're a Republican, as you look at that Pew poll that said, you know, Trump has a huge approval rating, but like 44% of people want him to be the nominee in 2024, which just maybe suggests that part of the approval for him, though scary on the levels that I suggested earlier, it's that maybe there's like a gold watch contingent to this. Like, we like Donald Trump. We're all with him on everything, but we don't really want him to be the nominee again. Maybe that will be what kicks in as we go forward. Maybe. But the problem is everybody's basically like, who's going to stand up to him? I mean, who's going to run against him it's all about the swagger, as you said, to some extent. There's got to be a guy or a woman, you know, who's willing to stand up and be not someone who will be immediately dismissed as a rhino. You know, is that, again, I'm not like a big fan of Ron DeSantis, but like, is there someone out there who is going to stand up and be like, you know, I must take this guy down. I just don't see it right now. I don't see who that candidate is, who is the modern version of George W. Bush, who could stand up and take Trump out. And in the absence of someone strong to take him out, he's a bulldozer. And the energy of the base, and these causes that he's rallying people to, the deepening culture war. And we know what the Republican primary vote is like. It's not Joe Scarborough Republicans. It's Republicans who, you know, are much more in the activist wing of the party. And that wing is energized and more, as I said before, more violent. We're now seeing than it's ever been before. And that's, I think, the cause for so much alarm, is that Trump is willing to do anything. Past behavior suggests future intent and future behavior. We now know what Trump's capable of. He's capable of fucking anything. He's capable of unleashing a mob on the Capitol to beat police officers with flagpoles. You know, that's what he's willing to do to get power. And I think anybody who pretends like that's not what he'll be willing to do heading into 2024 is fooling themselves.
Now, you have all these platforms to cover this, to cover this story. I mean, you're the circus, you're traveling all the time with a circus. You've got the recount. I'm not really sure how you juggle it all. But in your mind, how do you separate what you're going to do for the circus, what you're going to do for the recount, what you're going to do for your writing? I've always been curious. How do you organize this stuff in your mind?
Well, the only way I can do it all is with very high grade pharmaceuticals. And the only way I can organize it all in my mind is arbitrarily and capriciously. Like, there's no really good.
I like it.
You know, I mean, you know, all of these institutions, these things have their own, you know, their own energy to them. So, you know, the circus is a collaborative venture, and I have three co-hosts and a team of people make the show. So people have, you know, the show kind of decides what it's going to do. And we all have voices in that. You know, and the recount operates kind of on its own. It's like, I'm kind of involved in having founded it, and I'm highly involved in kind of thinking about its editorial strategy and how to make that thing go forward. But it's not like I don't have a show on the recount. So it's like, you know, I go on MSNBC and say my piece with you guys and others on the network. So it kind of, you know, on one hand, it's like, well, how do you decide? Well, you make these decisions on the fly and you know, try to set up different ways of trying to cover what's important that allow, you know, some of it's direct and some of it's indirect and some of it's, you know, through the agency of people who work for me and some of it's through my own mouth. And that gives me a bunch of different ways to say things. But I will say that one of the things that's happened, and I think you've seen this, I mean, you guys have really, I mean, I went back and do a content analysis of Morning Joe, you know, you would see in the course of 2020 and through now, as the notion that, and Mika's is on point about this as anybody I know, as the notion that what's really on the table here is America going to continue to be a democracy or not?
Right.
As that has become the front and center question, a question that we all thought was unimaginable as recently as like 4 years ago, as that question has become front and center, it's like, what else matters? I mean, we talk about some other, there's other things we talk about, you know, I mean, we can't just talk about that all day.
Right.
But it's hard for me to think that in terms of what should we cover, I think, you know, that's the main thing we have to be talking about, because I don't think it's hyperbolic to say the thing that Gerson said the other day or the thing that Fiona Hill said the other day, if Trump wins in 2024, Republicans control the House and Senate, democracy dies in America. Crazy ass thing to say. I mean, like something you and I could never have imagined saying ever before in our lives. And I think it's not hyperbole at this point. It's just it's what the stakes are. And that makes it a lot easier to decide what you're doing, because like what else, you know, everything else seems kind of marginal.
Everything does seem marginal. You know, it's my only caveat there is, and it always drives Mika crazy when I say, well, hold on a second, maybe democracy's not dead. The one thing that I haven't heard a lot of people talk about in talking about the death of democracy, if that were to happen in 2024, is, of course, the third branch. And that is the federal judiciary. It's the one branch that held up in 2020. If you want to look at a branch of government that actually saved Madisonian democracy, it was the courts. I think we're going to have to see some evidence between now and 2024 that there's going to be some weakening there, some cracks in the foundation there. Before I'm there with you and with Mika saying, if Democrats lose in 2024, if we see Trump and Republicans take control of everything in 2024, then democracy's dead. I still would hold out hope that the judiciary holds the line like they did in 2020.
Right.
But I don't want to take that chance.
Well, and let me pull back. I mean, like, I'll say just this. That was a Fiona Hill quote. And I don't want to be inevitable about anything. All I'll say is that I think these are the stakes.
Well, let me just say, Mika is inevitable. So that's the only reason why when I hear it, I just say, well, hold on a second. Let's take a breath.
Right.
Let's look at what Trump's own federal judges did in 2020.
Right. But let's just say this. That this is what's at stake.
Yeah,
you know what's at stake is the it's an existential question for whether, you know, we'll see, democracy might hold, you know, and you know, but when you look around at what's happening at the state level and these and the transference of power over how elections are conducted from nonpartisan election officials to Trump stooges and lackeys and toadies and party hacks.
Yeah,
that's, I mean, I think the underpinnings of it. I agree with you that so far the courts have held to a large extent. But I guess without having to predict, if Trump wins in 2024, democracy dies.
Right.
Maybe not. But we're headed towards a series of elections in 2022 and 2024 that will put, I think, the most significant stress test,
yeah,
way more than Trump did while he was in president.
Actually, that's what I was going to say. An amazing stress
test. An existential stress test to the foundation of our democracy. That's what we're about to face in these next two elections. That, I think, is not overstating things. And I do think that Trump has every intent and every willingness would, in a heartbeat, without hesitation, try to enact a successful coup in a more sinister, yeah, insidious, and far-reaching way than he did in 2020, and try to learn from his mistakes then and do better in his view,
yeah,
the next time around. I just think that is, you know, that I have no doubt about.
Yeah. So how's crime in the city where you are?
Well, you know,
I only ask because I'm hearing, it sounds like I've been hearing activity outside your, yeah, I'm just trying to figure out what part of Columbia you're in right now.
No, there was we're downtown, Joe. That's the thing we get when an ambulance goes by. It might have nothing to do with crime, but we hear the siren. So I can't see what,
Downtown Medellin?
I can't see. Well, I've got only, I only wish.
Are you on the Upper West Side?
No, we're down in Tribeca. I'm way downtown.
Oh, of course you are. That's right. When was the last time you've been north of 4th Street?
The recount offices are north of that, and I was up in 30 Rock with you not that long ago. So I occasionally it's really what you never see above 50th is a little rare for me. I've not seen the Upper West Side in a very long time, or the Upper East Side. I don't even know where that is. I think that's like.
Well, we may have to be like North Korean and South Korean leaders. We can meet at 50th, shake hands, and then go our separate ways. I feel at home at Upper West Side. I grew up in a Baptist church.
Yeah.
My best friend became a missionary. I obviously went the opposite direction. I was always fascinating when Steve would come back from being in the field, because he had this wonderful gift. He could see how things had changed in America. If he went to Singapore for 5 years, or if he went to the Middle East for 5 years, he would come back. And I mean, he was there. It wasn't like I'm coming back for Christmas. He would be there. And so he'd come back, and I always would get together with him, and I'd say, so tell me,
yeah,
what's America like? Because when you're just sitting there, you don't understand. And he would say, the change is just, it's incredible. It's breathtaking. Usually, being a missionary, he didn't think it was for the better, but he would talk, and I'd say, oh my God, so that you're right. A lot has happened culturally in the past 5 years, politically in the past 5 years. You obviously were up to your neck in politics with the circus. You followed it around for 6 years. You've been in the middle of the storm for 6 years straight, but you took off because of COVID. So I'm going to ask you the same question I asked my friend Steve. You've come back 6 months later. What's it like? Is it even worse than it was before you left?
Well, no, it's like,
more divided.
I mean, unlike a lot of people, because of the circus and the fact that we went out and covered the election, and we were out from the beginning of August of last year, right in the middle of those first few months we were all kind of in hiding in during COVID, but you know, we were out back on the road out covering the election from August till November. So we were in a little bit of an unusual circumstance in the sense that I wasn't really in total lockdown. And then in January and February and March, we were down in DC for the transition. And so I feel like it's more like I've had kind of a, I've kind of watched the way that the country's like reacted to COVID, and it's striking. I'll tell you this, you know, the country's more divided. The fact that that COVID became the subject of this massive culture war, and the stuff, again, you talk about this on the show a fair amount. We do when it comes up. This fact that, you know, that somehow one of the most kind of disgusting legacies of Trump is that, and I think it's a disgusting legacy of some other factors also. But the fact that we have this crazy debate over vaccines. First it was over masks, now it's over vaccines. Like the degree of cultural division on things like that kind of astonishes me, even though the story of polarization is like the story of my life of 30 years covering politics. The country's gotten more and more polarized, more and more bitter, more and more divided over the course of 30 years. But it's really, it's such an extreme thing what we're seeing now with these school boards and in these hospitals and the fights over mandates and all this stuff. I mean, it's out of control. And the second thing is, you know, there have been all these false dawns with COVID where, you know, people would say, well, we're about to, you know, this summer, well, we're going to bust out. COVID's going to, you know, we got the vaccines. Everything's going to be great. Everyone's going to come out. And I, you know, we come back to New York and it didn't really feel like it to me, even, you know, in that hot vac summer, it's going to be fun. And then, you know, before the Delta variant happened, never really felt like that. Now it feels like that here. It feels normal. It's starting to feel actually normal again back
in
New York.
Like, that's good.
It's starting to feel like people are in the streets and people are moving around. And, you know, I was down in Texas last week and boy, man, Joe, you want to go someplace that'll freak you out. You know, go down and check into a hotel in San Antonio and realize there is no one at the hotel. People who work there, people who visit there, people hanging out there, people staying there, not a single person in a mask. There's no mask in.
I love Texas.
Yeah, I love Texas.
I love Texas. I love San Antonio. They haven't been wearing a whole lot of masks, though, over the past year and a half, have they?
No, they have not. And I walked in. I was like, well, this is the first time I've been in a public place indoors where no one's in a mask in 18 months. And, I was like, I'm going to go to my room.
Yeah. So let me ask you. This brings up, I wasn't going to ask you this question, but I think this is good self-reflection for us. The media has been accused of overreacting, overreaching on Trump, overreacting, overreaching on COVID, overreaching on a lot of different issues. I think there are one or two people who have newsletters for Substack whose names I will not repeat because I don't want to give anybody any oxygen or light. But they spend all their time, weirdly enough, from the left, carrying water for Donald Trump, carrying water for people who hate America. And all they do is talk about all the mistakes that the media's made, all the mistakes that our government's made, all the mistakes that our intel community's made. I think the media, we've made a lot of mistakes. I think we've overreached at times. One of the things that horrified me was when I found out that that what we had been reporting on as far as the bounties on the heads of Marines in Afghanistan, that it wasn't a sure thing, that in fact that there were some agencies that had low to moderate confidence that story was correct, but it was just preached as gospel. So that was a mistake. In COVID, I guess once or twice we've overreached. I still think that social distancing and masks and obviously vaccines, absolutely critical. But I'm just curious, is there anything where you look back and say, well, maybe we went too far. Maybe we made this mistake or that mistake in covering Donald Trump or in covering COVID, where we played into the hands of those people who hate the media, who, I'll say it, who hate America, who hate the intel communities, who want to disparage us as a country. Anything we do where we overreach there?
Oh man, I don't know. I'm trying to think of. I mean, the bounty story is a good story that you mentioned as a specific example. You know, I find like so much of this. People give an example that we've all been slammed for, right? You know, I give it an obvious example is after Andrew Cuomo had all of his, was exposed to have been a serial sexual harasser and was driven out of the
room. Right.
People will go back and play video of us all praising him in the early days of COVID.
Right.
Now do I look back on the positive things I said about Andrew Cuomo then and feel embarrassed that he turned out to be a sexual harasser? No, not really. I mean, I thought Randy Cuomo was doing a pretty good job on COVID. We didn't know about the nursing home thing when we were saying right. those things, and we didn't know about the sexual harassment thing. I think, you know, I think just a lot of every as far as I know in my career, the media, I've seen myself and my colleagues make mistakes. Over 30 years, we all get stuff wrong, whether it's analytically wrong or we misread the importance of something, where we exaggerate something or we downplay something that turns out to be more important than we thought. I mean, for every time that someone says to me, well, you guys just, you know, do you exaggerate how bad Trump is? I think, well, I'm more concerned about the fact that we didn't see how dangerous he was in 2016. I mean, if I want to criticize myself, I'd go back and say that I didn't think that Trump was capable of the kind of behavior that we saw between November 7th and January 6th of 2020 and 2021. People said it. They said, you know, this guy's a thug and an autocrat and an aspiring authoritarian. And I laughed at that in 2015. I thought he was just a buffoon. Mm-hmm. So I think we make mistakes in both directions. We sometimes overplay things. We sometimes underplay things. What I really care about is whether you can discern that the people who are trying to do the best they do every day to be accurate and be fair and to assess how important things are, do they seem like they're doing it because, in your words, do they care about America or do they care about democratic values? Do they care about holding powerful interests to account? Are they doing it for the right reasons? Because everyone's going to make mistakes. And all that happens, the thing you're talking about, the Substack people, it's just also partisan weaponized, you know, the weaponization of our mistakes against us. You know, like I could do that all day long, that's shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah.
If I want to just like take someone down for an ideological reason, I can point out every mistake you've made make you look like an asshole. But I that's not my game, man. I'm like, you know, these mistakes, sometimes the overestimations, the underestimations, the things that we came to conclusions based on incomplete facts, and then there were new facts that came out later that caused you to revise your view. These are just the nature of the business, right? Are we trying our best to do it right?
Yeah.
Or are we wielding these facts to serve a political or an ideological agenda? That's, I think, problematic. I think the thing that we do is we sometimes get stuff wrong because people get stuff wrong.
Yeah.
And we should go back and correct the record when we screw it up. You know, we should go back and say, you know what? I thought this then. turns out I was wrong. Now I learned some new things. You know, when I learned those new things, I'll acknowledge that that was wrong back then, and we'll move on.
Yeah. And how hilarious that they'll, of course, if the media admits they're wrong,
they'll use that against you too, right? It's like
they'll jump up and down on that and use that against you and say, see, and so you can't win either way. Well, John, listen, I appreciate all the time that you've given me, and I look forward to talking to you soon. And I hope one day I will be big enough to be able to go back on your podcast.
Well, Joe, I'll just say, here's the thing. I have to exit this podcast. And the problem with you and me is that, if we set out with the best of intentions to talk for 30 minutes, 30 minutes is like, it would be a nice podcast episode, right? 30 minutes, that'd be good.
Exactly.
Very solid, right?
Yes. Yeah. We can't do that.
We will spend the first 70 minutes talking about pop music or rock music.
Music, yeah.
And then, and then it's finally, well, oh yes, we got to talk about something else. And it's just like, you know, without any time constraints, we would talk for 4 hours about all the stuff that we like to talk about, because we both are gabby and we like a lot of the same shit. So it's like,
we do.
So there's got to be some artificial constraint, or else this will eat our day.
Well,
and
exactly.
Mika will be mad at you, and Diana will be mad at me, and I can't really like live that way.
Well, we have families, we have jobs. We can't just talk about me. We didn't even get a chance to talk about baseball. We didn't get
a
chance to talk about what you're watching on TV. I was going to ask you what you thought about the end of Billions. I was going to ask you about Lasso. We'll get that next
time. The Succession premiere is Sunday night. The first episode of season 3 of Succession.
Lord.
There's so many things we could say. We're not going to talk about it, but I will say all those things you just mentioned. Sports, TV, film. We haven't talked about any of it. We'll get it next time.
We didn't even talk about Bill Cosby. We were going to talk about Bill Cosby. We'll get in trouble next time.
Yeah. All right, bro. Good to see you.
Hey, John, as always, thanks so much for doing this. And love to thank all of you for being with us. We'll see you next time on the Joe Scarborough Podcast.